Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast. Hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's day, Thursday, November 1, 2018. So I have been told, brand new trend, book club being moved to Thursdays on the cows. Book club had been on Fridays for 5 years, 6 years. Started the book club in 2012, 6 years, making the switcheroo because Stacy specifically in the UK, she's been a loyal listener for a long time and has been actively participating in workplace racism on Thursdays for about a year and a half, maybe even longer than that now, consistently participating and staying awake until about 4 a.m., her time to contribute. And she said it would be easier not only for her, but for other non-white people who participate in workplace racism who are outside the states. It would be easier if that program were on Friday. That way, many of them, they don't have to work on Saturday, so they could stay up later without it being as much of a problem. But just to stay up that late for a year and a half, and the other non-white people who live outside the states who call in to participate, I thought it would be worth the investment. So moving forward, book club on Thursdays. That said, the last book that we read, the late Pamela Evans Harris, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. I said and stand by, worst book I have ever read. Numerous inaccuracies, incorrectly attributing quotes to Mr. Fuller that he did not say, and rife with black misandry. Again, Pam meant a lot to the program and Gus T. personally. She was super close, and she is sorely missed by myself and many, many Cows listeners and supporters of her work. That does not in any way negate the inaccuracies and black misandry in Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. I will have to say that I am thankful that we read that book in the same manner that I'm thankful that we read The Hate U Give, formerly the worst book I ever read. I'm thankful that we read that book also. Obviously, I didn't enjoy either of these texts, but I think it's important because The Hate U Give, now they have the movie and it's so popular to have an analysis, what I think a counter-racist analysis of this text that is so popular and that's being promoted to children. I think Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. I grossly, grossly miss or minimized the intensity of black misandry. That, I mean, was just a huge error in my analysis of racism, white supremacy. We have the text. to help get some perspective and to help correct that. And apparently with the large number of listeners, males and females, who did not think there was anything awry with Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, which was also appalling to Gus T because it's so rife and flagrant in the text, that apparently many, many of us are infected with Black misandry. That's my only conclusion. We did have some folks who said that they did not read the entire text, so that could be an issue as well, but it could be both. That's only conclusion that I can come to. And in order to address that, we will be reading The Man Knot, Dr. Tommy J. Curry's 2017 publication, guest on this program many times over the years. Will be grand to read the book. So if we come up with questions, we can email or even ask if he could make a cameo appearance and do some explaining if there are any errors or something that we think is not accurate or not explained well in the text. I do want to take one moment before we move on to The Man Knot, Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood. I do want to take one moment, though, to read the first page from the book that we were supposed to read, The Interracial Con Game. That's the book. The original plan, we were going to read Black Love as a Revolutionary Act and then follow that up with The Interracial Con Game. And because of the inaccuracies and Black misandry, I decided that, you know, we could not continue with reading the texts and we would have to switch up. We're reading The Man Knot. So the first page of the book that Gus T. decided not to read. This is the first page, because I know we have many listeners who have not read The Interracial Con Game, so you don't know what's in the book. We have many listeners who have not been with the context of white supremacy for the full decade that we've been on the air. So this is page one of The Interracial Con Game. To our beautiful Black women, our mothers, wives, lovers, sisters, and daughters. To our strong, courageous Black brothers, fathers, and sons, wherever you are fighting for justice. And a very special dedication to Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, Neely Fuller Jr., the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X, Rosa Parks, Marcus Garvey, Gus Renegade. Acknowledgements. This book could not have been written or completed without the groundbreaking works of Neely Fuller Jr., Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Dr. Yosef Benyakinen, John Henry Clark, Marcus Garvey, Dr. Mwalimu K. Baruti, Chancellor Williams, Malcolm X, George Orwell, Tony Brown, Jawanza Kanjufu, Carter G. Woodson, James Baldwin, Willard Motley, and many others too numerous to mention. Naturally, we accept total responsibility for any misinterpretations of their works and any errors that may appear in this book. A very special thanks to Gus Renegade, Cowles, Ed Williams, counter-racism.com, D.H., Wendy Williams, R. Parker, J. Wickett, Josh Wickett, D.B., K. Richardson, D. Robinson, and all our friends, families, and mentors who shared their special insights, wisdom, and patience with us. I will stop there. That's page one from The Interracial Con Game. I will be the first one to say there is one name in the dedication that for sure should not be on that list. However, that being said, how close were Pam and Gus? Again, just for folks, I'm sure, who have not read, this is the book that I'm saying, no, we're not going to read because of the errors and Black misandry in the book that we just finished. This is the book. a book, if you turn over on the back of the book, who wrote the review? That's what I mean. This is the one of the very few times where I'll say, no, it's not a case where I could be wrong. Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, has a number of inaccuracies, and is rife with black misandry. Pam and I were very close, as I said before. I am sure closer than anybody listening to this program, unless her family has tuned in to the cows. Exhibit A, what I just read. Her and I being close has nothing to do with whether or not information presented is accurate, whether or not information presented is filled with anti-black male bias. Those are two separate entities, period. The new book that we are reading, Dr. Tommy J. Curry, The Man Knot, Race, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood, published in 2017. You can go in the archives and hear our discussion of the text a few days after it was published. And I will go ahead and say up front, this is a challenging book. You will need a dictionary. There will be words that you do not understand. Look them up. That way you will get a better understanding of what's being said. This is a book you do not want to listen to casually and think that you understand what's being said. You're really going to have to pay attention. It would be best to actually have the physical text so that you can follow along. This is not an easy read, but wow, it has a lot of, I think, important information. Dr. Curry, The Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number one, The Man Knot. Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood, Dr. Tommy J. Curry. Introduction. Toward a Genre Study of Black Male Death and Dying, addressing the caricatures that serve as theory in the study of black males. I see dead black male bodies. Black men and boys in the streets. Dead niggers made into YouTube sensations. I see their executions on the internet. The corpses of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Little Tamir Rice cycled for eternity. I hear Jordan Davis's music and Sean Bell's vows. I feel black male death all around me. And I am scared. Scared that one day I will be forced to not speak. They shame me when I speak about black men and boys. They threaten me with the names of white men. I hear patriarch, sexist, misogynist as they condemn me for identifying the murderers and lynch mobs of black males. They wear hoods with disciplinary embroidery, whispering nigger under their breaths. These black and white faces stand guard at the gates of the academy, and I fear they will make me be still. They will kill me. They will force me to remain silent. I write this knowing that my words will not outpace the bullet of another gun, transforming living flesh into rotting meat. I know as I write this that another black man or boy will die. I know as I think about their deaths, the end of their lives is coming to be. This America makes corpses of black males. It is simply the reality of our day that black males die. This death, however, is shunned, cast out of the halls of the university, and avoided at all costs by disciplines. This reality has not transformed any of the decadent theories that tie black manhood to the caricatures of the 1970s. Black men are thought to be latent rapists, the black macho of old, violent patriarchs, a privileged black male, craving the moment he is allowed to achieve the masculinity of whites. These mythologies of decades long gone remain the morality of disciplines and the political foundation from which racist caricatures become revered concepts. I write this book from a 21st century in which black men and boys are still being lynched in America. Otis Byrd was found hanging from a tree on March 20th, 2015 in Port Gibson, Mississippi, and Lennon Lacey's 17-year-old body was found on August 29th, 2014, hanging from a children's swing set in Bladenboro, North Carolina. I write from a 21st century in which black men such as Matthew Ajibade are hit in their genitals with a taser and beaten to death. I write to you from a 21st century where a black man named Kevin Campbell, a father stopped for driving on a suspended license, was confined to a cage for hours and anally sodomized by a Detroit police officer. I write to you from a world where an innocent black man can be deprived of decades from his life and convicted of rape because his face came to a woman in a dream as her rapist. This is the precariousness that has come to define what black men and boys endure as life. I write this book to give voice to the black male coerced into silence, his experiences denied within disciplines and his realities refused by theory. Theory is a fickle thing. The proliferation of discourses around sexuality over the past several decades has done little to clarify the relation between socially constructed gender categories such as race and sex and the biological bodies that possess them. Likewise, despite decades of debate, the category of masculinity remains indeterminate and somewhat vacuous, referenced almost solely by one's genitalia. The appearance of more complex theoretical advancements articulated by the crest of race, class, and gender has come to conceal rather than reveal significant and empirical aspects of black sexual life. Imposing analytic categories on bodies as substitutable for depicting actual social or historical relations obscures both the quotidian and the repetitive phenomena that materialize as various social stratifications. It is not uncommon for complex theories of masculinity to stand in stark contradiction to the actually observable positions of the groups they aim to reference. Whereas masculinity's studies outside the United States have begun the arduous task of assessing the presumed linkage among maleness, patriarchy, and domination, feminist theory in the United States has come to emphasize masculinity as primarily patriarchal and to claim those masculinities that do not coincide with this dominant gender hierarchy for itself as progressive and feminist inspired. These masculinity scholars from Europe and its past colonies have insisted on the difference between hegemonic and non-hegemonic masculinities and argued for a more accurate account of white men that further facilitates the discovery and identification of equality masculinities, those that legitimate an egalitarian relationship between men and women, between masculinity and femininity among men. They insist gendered power relations are dynamic, unstable, and ambiguous, and dominant forms of masculinity do not always legitimize patriarchy. Therefore, the question of men's patriarchal oppression of women must remain an open, empirical, and contextual question. Gender and masculinity researchers, therefore, need to develop theoretical frameworks that can grasp changes, complexities, ambivalences, ruptures, and resistance. While the male descendants of colonizers are recognized for the naturally occurring varieties of masculinities within their group, this insistence on multiple masculinities has often been denied to Black men who are the descendants of slaves. Theories concerning Black masculinity revolve around a fixed political idea in the United States that is deemed progressive by the extent to which it is sufficiently feminist and deemed patriarchal by the extent to which it is not. Unlike in mainstream masculinity scholarship, there have been few efforts to verify non-hegemonic Black masculinities sociologically or conceptually separate from the already established norms in gender studies. Black males, who are stereotyped as hyper-masculine and violent throughout society, are intuitively marked as patriarchal within theory. Instead of being similarly disrupted by the critiques of hegemonic masculinity's failure to account for the class and cultural diversity within white masculinities, hyper-masculinity is proposed as the phylogenetic marker of Black maleness. Consequently, Black males are thought to be the exemplifications of white bourgeois masculinity's pathological excess. In other words, the toxic abnormality of a hegemonic white masculinity becomes the conceptual norm for Black men and boys. Black males are often theorized as defective. As the gender theorist Arthur F. St. Aubin explains, even when Black men are the ostensible subjects, they are, in fact, objects of workshops, special journals editions, etc., they are still marginalized theoretically and compared to a norm by which they are usually judged lacking. Because Black men are not subjects of or in theories emanating from their own experience, they are often conceptualized as the threats others fear them to be. This fear has been used to legitimize thinking of Black males as degraded and deficient men who compensate for their lack of manhood through deviance and violence. As the social scientist Andrea G. Hunter and James Earl Davis explain, studies of Black women emphasize how out of oppression a unique definition of womanhood was forged, one in which adversity gave rise to strength. However, the discourse around men and oppression focuses on the stripping away of manhood. It is a perspective that casts Black men as victims and ignores their capacity to define themselves under difficult circumstances. This paradigm is far too prevalent to not warrant remark. Racist accounts of Black males depict them as lesser males who are lazy, unintelligent, aggressive, and violent toward women and children, and who abandon their families physically and cannot provide for them economically, while nonetheless requiring coercive legal and extralegal sanctions to control their hypermasculinity and predatory inclinations. Racism against Black men often results in their emasculation, criminalization, and death. Black men have not only survived, but developed rich analyses of their oppression under the capitalist ethno-patriarchal regime we call white supremacy. However, their thoughts are not spoken of as positive programs capable of actually addressing their suffering. The concepts emerging from Black male experience are often described as pathological coping mechanisms fixated on Black males achieving their manhood at any cost, rather than liberatory ideas applicable to all Blacks. Consequently, Black men's experiences of racism are framed as one-dimensional, narrow, and devoid of any analyses that understand the horrors of sexual violence. Such claims, however, severely underestimate the complexity of Black male subjugation under racist social systems and within periods of colonization. As early as Calvin Herndon's Sex and Racism in America, there has been a realization that racial hatred is carnal hatred, sexualized hatred, a phallicism or process that criminalizes Black males as sexual threats like the rapist, while simultaneously constituting them as the carnal excesses and fetishes of the white libido. Racism is a complex nexus, a cognitive architecture used to invent, reimagine, and evolve the presumed political, social, economic, sexual, and psychological superiority of the white races in society, while materializing the imagined inferiority and hastening the death of inferior races. Said differently, racism is the manifestation of the social processes and concurrent logics that facilitate the death and dying of racially subjugated peoples. At the center of this complexity, the regenerative arc, so to speak, of this ideology is the character of the racialized men as threats to the social and biological reproduction of white order. Simply put, one of the motivations behind European-American racism, as discerned, for example, in certain racial myths and stereotypes, in certain civil and criminal statutes regarding miscegenation and rape, and in the history of racial brutality like lynching, is a fear of Black male sexuality and a need to control Black masculinity. For the idea of an all-powerful white male figure to achieve cultural institutionalization and buy-in from the masses, the dominant culture needs its nigger boys, its ugly inferior, its other, in order to construct itself as superior and beautiful men. The Black male, the nigger, was constructed as the white race's antipodal monstrosity, a sexual threat to the very foundation of white civilization if its savagery was not repressed. These speciations from the ideal white male type are examples of the testeric condition that plagues Black maleness generally in the United States. Because testeria emerges from the disjunctive isolation Black maleness has from the normative maleness that is represented as white, the testeric, or the cool poser, or the eunuch, manifests the repression of the social order corporeally, in his flesh, as Pavlovian peculiarities to stave off death. The death of Black males is meant to prevent his reproduction and impede his ability to reproduce. This is the boundary between the abject and the corpse the Black male inhabits. It is the peculiar genre Black males occupy and the place from which their perspectives emanate. The man knot, as a philosophical grounding for a genre study of Black male death and dying. Black male death and suffering is thought to be generic, captured solely by the category of race. Race, however, is not an efficacious category of analysis under our present intersectional and post-structural arrangement. Race is a category under constant disciplinary surveillance, exposing it to a seemingly infinite number of attacks for being overdetermined and essentialist, and therefore in need of any combination of experimental anti-essentialist solutions. This dispersion, deconstruction, dismissal of the race category has concrete consequences for Black males attempting to situate and describe their experience and history, because race has been the only category offered by disciplines through which Black men can theoretically articulate their experience. Consequently, Black males find themselves articulating their concerns through alien theories rooted in this displacement. Because race is accepted as socially constructed, all cultural and experiential products from a racial perspective remain suspect. Race consciousness is problematized and rejected prima facie as narrow and masculine, while gender, as Oyoronke Oyowumi reminds us, remains inextricably tied to biological notions of the female despite the performative and cultural situatedness of the term. Black and female allows for standpoints, histories, and experiences that serve to ground gender theory, while Black and male is taken to be the historical perspective that must be disowned to free these other gendered, not male, voices. It is routinely insisted that race and gender are socially constructed and illusory. Yet it is only race that is displaced, while gender, being synonymous with female, is centered as the dominant theoretical voice of Black subjectivity and vulnerability, a centering technique that depends on the sustaining anthropological assumptions of white gender categories, not those disfigured within the negation of Blackness, the non-human, non-being matrices authored within chattel slavery and colonialism. Gender becomes the symbolic representation of bodies, their intent, while race simply acts as a modifier and operates to overdetermine or lessen the power position of maleness. Consequently, gender studies becomes discourses about women, where racialized men are interpreted by the lack of power they have compared with real white men. Black men simply do not exist as viable social subjects or reflective entities given their disfigurement within the established gender order. Rooting gender within the biological confines of the female body makes thinking about gender synonymous with thinking about women, the who and what they relate to. In this biomythos, the female is taken to be the taxonomic origin of gendered knowledge and history, where that which is defined as not female can only be outside and barred from creating gender theory. Because maleness has come to be understood as synonymous with power and patriarchy, and racially codified as white, it has no similar existential content for the Black male, who in an anti-Black world is denied maleness and is ascribed as feminine in relation to white masculinity. If whiteness is masculine in relation to Blackness, then Blackness becomes rationally defined as not masculine and feminine, because it lacks the power of white masculinity. Thus, Black maleness is, in fact, a degendered negation of white maleness that is feminine because of its subordinate position to white masculinity, but not female because Black maleness lacks a specific gender coordinate that corresponds to either white maleness or white femaleness, and, as shown later, relates to the white female primarily as rapist. Maria Lugones similarly emphasizes the anachronism of attributing gender to the colonized and enslaved bodies we now think of through the frameworks of Black masculinity and Black femininity. As she remarks, under the imposed gender framework of colonial modernity, The bourgeois white Europeans were civilized. They were fully human. The hierarchical dichotomy as a mark of the human also became a normative tool to damn the colonized. The behavior of the colonized and their personalities, souls, were judged as bestial and thus non-gendered, promiscuous, sexual, and sinful. The colonized, racialized subject was denied gender precisely to define the boundaries between the content of the human and the deficit of those racially speciated. This is not to say there was no sexual differentiation between bodies and the roles assigned to them. Rather, it highlights that colonized people became male and female. Males became not human as not men, and colonized females became not human as not women. The black man deprived not only of an identity, but also a history and existence that differs from his brute negation, experiences the world as a man-not. Man-notness is a term used to express the specific genre category of the black male. Genre differs from gender by this distance black males share with Western man a priori, and, by consequence, patriarchy. Whereas gender asserts that historical and social orders defined by the biologic marker of sex are in fact synonymous with the historical and sociological location of black males, genre expresses how the register of non-being distorts the categories founded upon white anthropology or that of the human. Popular categories of analysis, such as class, gender, and even race, suppose a universal human template upon which they imprint. But what is the applicability of human categories on the non-human? The black male is negated not from an origin of human being, but from nihility. France Fanon's reflections on objecthood and not being are not simply descriptions of negation. They are not terms of proxemics, but terms of register. Non-being expresses the condition of black male being, the nihility from which it is birthed. Away from the bourgeois order of kind expressed by man, genre is specific to the kind, the type of existence expressed by the black male. For Sylvia Winter, genre indicates the disruption of the order founded on European man and woman, which is expressed by the term gender. The contact of Europe with non-Europeans reordered the gender schema because the primary code of difference now became that between men and natives, with the traditional male and female distinctions now coming to play a secondary, if nonetheless powerful, reinforcing role within the system of symbolic representations. Insofar as blackness expresses the indeterminacy of being as non-being, gender, too, is reformulated. This is why Winter coined the word genre to replace gender. She writes, genre and gender come from the same root. They mean kind. What I am suggesting is that gender has always been a function of the instituting of kind. The man-not grows from the incongruity I observed between what theory claims to explain and the actual existence of black men and boys, an actual reality that remains excluded from its purview. Simply stated, Analyzing Black Males as the Man Not is a theoretical formulation that attempts to capture the reality of Black maleness in an anti-Black world. Because it is rooted in the colonial formulation of sex designation, not gender, the Man Not recognizes that racial maleness is not coextensive with or synonymous to the formulations of masculinity or patriarchy offered by white reality. The Man Not is the denial not only of Black manhood, but also of the possibility to be anything but animal, the savage beast outside the civilizational accounts of gender. To suggest that Black males are, in fact, gendered patriarchs is an erasure of the actual facts of anti-Black existence and a substitution of the white anthropological template at the core of negating Black male existence as its end. Michael Brown's death, like that of Vonderit Myers, Oscar Grant, John Crawford III, Jordan Davis, Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, and Stephen Watts, represents the accumulation of an intellectual failure to grasp the complexities and the motivations implicated within the genocidal logics of American racism beyond the categories of modern taxonomy. The negrophobia that drove white America to endorse lynching as a technology of murder is the same anxiety and fear that now allow the white public to endorse the murder of Black men and boys as justifiable homicides. Black males are often killed by police officers because the officers claim they fear for their lives that Black men have life-threatening weapons or guns. This phobia is a normalized and institutional program used to justify police violence, ostracism, and incarceration. It is a fear that is given so much weight in individual cases precisely because it is a fear that both white America and many non-white Americans share. The vulnerability of Black men and boys lies in this consensus, and it is one that extends beyond the borders of white psychopathology. It is an American maxim propagated through the mass media and the assumptions of liberal progressive gender politics and internalized by the populations Black, white, male, or female that consume these mythologies and images. In academic philosophy, there has yet to be a text that deals specifically with the history and theorization of Black males. While there are accounts of Black men and boys throughout the social sciences, mostly focused on the obstacles facing this group, the discipline of philosophy has made no such efforts to investigate Black maleness beyond its alleged privileged position to that of the Black woman or its undesirability, hyper-masculinity, Black nationalism, and so on. Heavily influenced by intersectional feminist accounts of race and gender, Black men are thought to exemplify a privileged, disadvantaged status that obscures our viewing of gender when their reality or subjectivity is centered. Rooted in an idealist calculus, Black men are conceptualized as empowered by their male identity such that any asymmetry between intra-racial groups where Black men, for example, are more visible or more represented than Black women is attributed to patriarchy. This book aims for a closer interdisciplinary examination of this gendered claim. Using history, sociology, and a range of social science findings, this book argues that Black men and boys are, in fact, disadvantaged because of their maleness. Taking the Black male experience seriously shows that what is now called gender is cumulative, not casual, and while certain problems may accumulate around male or female bodies, they are not isolated to those bodies or their histories. Hence, instead of being protected by patriarchy, Black men and boys are revealed to be its greatest victims under closer examination. This book is not predetermined. It is not merely an articulation of a foregone conclusion. It was not written as the imposition of a theory onto Black males as objects of study, in which the desired conclusion was decided before the research into Black men and boys as complex subjects even began. This book theorizes Black male life in the United States, its dying, and the reality of its death. In other words, this text aims not only to use theory to draw tenable conclusions from the actual data on intimate partner violence, homicide, and incarceration as it pertains to Black men and boys, but also to use data to inform the abstract themes that, according to gender theorists, explain Black males' social reality. Far too often, Black males are projected into academic projects as the stereotypes individuals perceive them as rather than how they actually exist in the world. This book was written to overwhelm the silence imposed on Black males through negative racial caricatures that become absolved of their moral offensiveness once they are called gender theory. Ideas of Black men as abusers of women and children, rapists, and power-hungry deviants run rampant throughout the academy and inform what is intuitively expressed as academic gender theory. Is there sufficient evidence, however, to ground these theories? While there is tacit agreement among American institutions, courts, prisons, the press, and so forth, that will be ideologically supported in their rationalizations and financially rewarded for their actions, this is not the full scope of Black male vulnerability. Black males also endure societal discrimination and social ostracism because of their maleness. In his personal life, the discrimination targeting the Black male in the workforce often results in his unemployment, which only confirms that he is undesirable and unwanted as a colleague or peer within universities, corporations, and many blue-collar occupations. He is assumed to be a deviant, so his history of trauma and physical or sexual abuse at the hands of men or women, which precipitates many of his interpersonal conflicts as an adult, is denied. He is interpreted as a violent and abusive individual in need of criminal sanction rather than as a victim in need of treatment and compassion. This book is concerned with the sociological, historical, and ontological weight of Black manhood. It explores how the myth of the super predator is codified within the disciplinary proliferation of theories about Black masculinity and makes it seemingly impossible to conceptualize the Black male as a victim and disadvantaged when compared with other groups. This book shows how theory and stereotype converge throughout the multiple exegeses offered to analyze the external conditions and internal motivations of Black men and boys. Academic theory uses the same pathological explanations of Black male deviance, violence, and abuse that continue to haunt Black males and justify their murder in society. To advance theory, the vulnerability of the Black male is denied and his disadvantage is obscured from a full viewing by scholars and the public. He is thought of only as a perpetrator, never a victim. The Man Knot was thought of as a corrective of sorts, as a concept of Black males that could challenge the historical and theoretical accounts of Black men and boys that have proliferated throughout disciplines and are taken as gospel in academic research. This book is the first philosophical exploration of the oppression of the Black male that aims to synthesize the multiple findings and research concerning his condition across disciplines. Rather than simply reproduce sociological findings highlighting his societal disadvantage, I create a theory and operational paradigm by which we can understand the intellectual, historical, and sexual diversity of Black men. While such an exploration will never capture the full experience of Black male homosexuality any more than the Black male's heterosexual experience or his denied and condemned polyamory, The Man Knot is an attempt to reflectively engage the conditions that dictate the formation of Black male sexualities and the historical vulnerabilities that obscure our viewing of them as actual realities of Black manhood. This is a reflection not on identities, but rather the historical, material, the problems and experiences that contour how Black men have come to define themselves. This is a book to challenge how we think of and perceive the conditions that actually affect all Black males and why we choose to see some things but deny others. Black Masculinity as Buck Studies, documenting the links between hegemonic masculinity and the reality of Black males. The mimetic thesis, or the idea that Black males seek to emulate and ultimately realize themselves as patriarchs next to white men, has been a central feature of Black feminist ideology since the penning of Michelle Wallace's The Black Macho and the Myth of the Superwoman in the late 1970s. The emergence of the buck, the mythological heterosexual Black male figure that emerged from slavery as the basis of Black male political aspiration in the 20th century, has been a central feature of Black masculinity studies for the past four decades. Wallace's text reduced the complexities of political economics, racism, history, and class mobility to the genital level. She maintained that Black men had internalized the white man's obsession with his penis. As she said, white men were perversely obsessed with the Black man's genitals, but the obsession turned out to be a communicable disease, and in the 60s, Black men came down with high fevers. More than simply offering one perspective of the Black Power era, Wallace's text created a bridge between white patriarchy and Black male political aspirations that allowed the racially specific accounts of white patriarchal power, isolated to white feminist theories of dominance or hegemony, to extend to Black males. The Black Macho, the male chauvinist that was frequently cruel, narcissistic, and short-sighted, was birthed by Black men accepting the sexual primitivism of the Black male presupposed by whites. The Black man of the 1960s lost himself in the image of this brute, according to Wallace, making himself a living testament to the white man's failures. He suffered poverty, deprivation, and unhappiness because his Black perspective, like the white perspective, supported the notion that manhood is more valuable than anything else. Wallace makes a distinction between an organic and a mimetic Black manhood. As long as the Black man was able to hold on to his own Black-centered definition of manhood, his sense of himself was not endangered. The longer the Black male stayed in this country, the more he would get the Black and white perspectives confused. largely influenced by the adoption of Freudian psychoanalysis and the idea of black male assimilation into American society, contemporary black gender frames continue to understand black masculinity as striving to fulfill its Oedipal drive toward the father right of white masculinity. Under this paradigm, black males are reduced to their phallic aspirations for selfhood and seek to dominate others to compensate for their subjugation. Gender theorists in the 1990s asserted that phallocentrism, patriarchy, and black males lacking, be it of power, recognition, or a symbolic phallus, were a viable interpretive frame through which black maleness could be understood. Even today, black males are depicted as the absence of themselves for one another, having few attributes worth emulating. Their lack of black fathers, their lack of power in America, their lack of employment, their lack of manhood, all sociological phenomena, become the markers of their incompleteness. Demonstrations of their definitional, ontological failures as black males, rather than proof of their subordinated male status and existence in a completely different register of sexuality. Black males are not only defined by this lack, they are also thought to be complete only when they stand side by side with white men. Consequently, black masculinity is theorized through this psychoanalytic, unconscious yearning for the world of the white man, his power, and his possessions, which often include the white woman. By disregarding the historical examples of black male resistance to white supremacy, as well as the traditional expectations of hegemonic masculinity, supported even by black women at the anthropological level as Christian, capitalist, homophobic, and so forth, the black male is attached to patriarchy at a biological level, such that every action of self-defense, politics, or love becomes an exercise of his attempt to realize the patriarchy denied to him. Aaronette M. White summarizes this position in Black Gender Frames quite well. Though most African-American men do not experience the same level of power as most white American men, patriarchy produces pecking orders across different groups of men and within different subgroups of men. Each subgroup of men defines manhood in ways that conform to the economic and social possibilities of that group. However, even marginalized men, for example, poor men of color, accept the system because they benefit from the patriarchal dividend, which is the advantage men in general gain from the overall subordination of women, particularly the women in their subgroup. Accounts similar to White's thinking can be found throughout black masculinity literature, but the evidence that subordinated masculinity is of the same species as hegemonic masculinity, such that it can be of the kind that obtains this ideal, is sorely lacking. To substantiate the view that black men benefit from patriarchy despite their inferior social, economic, and racial status, White appeals to Raywan Connell's first edition of Masculinities as evidence for the claim that black men would be rewarded in a patriarchal society as men. This grounding of patriarchy in black male interest and his desire to be or be like the white male is suspicious. It suggests that while black men can articulate themselves as oppressed subjects to myriad structures and ideologies, from racism to classism, imperialism to colonization, and religion to atheism, gender remains unknown to them despite their role and history as subordinated men positioned outside the masculinity of ruling class whites in the United States. The lore of white patriarchy is a common trope used to explain the mimetic urge of black males. But why do we find no assumption of this imitative character in black feminist accounts of black womanhood, despite the vast historical works demonstrating the internalization of various Victorian gender ideals and social Darwinist theories, as well as their support for patriarchy as the basis of racial uplift during the 19th century? Black men and women have been subjected to the same cultural, ethnological, and anthropological theories rooted in racial evolution, yet only black males are thought to have internalized these historical views to such an extent that their sociological realities have been transformed into black masculine ontology. While much of black feminism historically has appealed to democratic reform and continued integration into institutions, or to protection and recognition by the law, attempts to codify black female vulnerability into societal institutions so that rape, domestic abuse, and discrimination are understood as violence to a living, breathing person, these appeals are recognized as calls for progressive change rather than a desire for the positionality and power of white womanhood, despite appeals to the same concepts and apparatuses that historically have sustained white women's, and men's, for that matter, economic and political power. There is no scholarship asserting that Sojourner Truth's Ain't I a Woman proves that she aspires to the powers, recognition, and status of white womanhood denied to her, but a litany that criticizes black men for the slightest similarity to white thought or rhetoric concerning manhood. Are only black males envious of the position of the dominant classes? Take, for example, Truth's famous condemnation of black men getting the right to vote, which has been quoted for years as evidence of the historical concern black women have had about black male political advancement. There is a great stir about colored men getting their rights, but not a word about the colored woman. And if colored men get their rights and not colored women theirs, you see, the colored men will be masters over the woman, and it will be just as bad as it was before. So I am for keeping the thing going while things are stirring, because if we wait till it's still, it will take a great while to get it going again. White women are a great deal smarter and know more than colored women, while colored women do not know scarcely anything. They go out washing, which is about as high as a colored woman gets, and their men go about idle. Truth believed black men were more brutal than the white men who orchestrated slavery, and black women were less intelligent than the white women who ruled over them. The historian Paula Giddings explains that the difficult circumstances of Truth's life gave her a distorted view of whites and blacks. Consequently, says Giddings, Truth shares a sentiment of black men eerily similar to that of Elizabeth C. Stanton, who believed that it would be better for a black woman to be the slave of an educated white man than of a degraded, ignorant black one. If Truth's quote remains a reminder of the danger black male politics has posed since the mid-19th century, then why are we not also suspicious of the allure white womanhood could have over black women? Think of Stokely Carmichael's statement, "The only position for women in the SNCC is prone," for instance. This sentence has become not only representative of him or of the ideology of the organization he represented, but also evidence of black males' patriarchal political inclination throughout the centuries. Mary King, a member of Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and the author of Freedom Song, A Personal Story of the 1960s Civil Rights Movement, offers a vastly different account of this oft-cited statement. Carmichael's comment pertained to a position paper circulated for the November 1964 Waveland meeting of the SNCC written by Mary King and Casey Hayden. The position paper spoke to the assumption of male leadership and the role of male and female workers of SNCC. The position papers were meant to get the leadership to think about foundational questions. What is SNCC? What do we organize? Where do we organize? The position paper on women asked the representatives to think about the role women played in the SNCC's leadership and decision-making structure. Specifically, the paper asked members to consider why it is in SNCC that women who are competent, qualified, and experienced are automatically assigned to the female kinds of job, such as typing, desk work, telephone work, filing, library work, cooking, and the assistant kind of administrative work, but rarely the executive kind. King fondly accounts that Carmichael made fun of everything that crossed his agile mind, and this position paper was no different. When he came to the not-so-anonymous woman's paper in the meeting, King recounts, "Looking straight at me, he grinned broadly and shouted, 'What is the position of women in SNCC?' Answering himself, he responded, 'The position of women in SNCC is prone.'" According to King, the now infamous statement by Carmichael was a joke. She remembers that Stokely threw back his head and roared outrageously with laughter. We all collapsed with hilarity. It drew us all closer together because even in that moment, he was poking fun at his own attitudes. Instead of describing Carmichael as some raging patriarchal maniac, King says, "Casey and I felt and continue to feel that Stokely was one of the most responsive men at the time that our anonymous paper appeared in 1964. Several years later, Hayden confirmed King's recollection of events in SNCC. Even in 2010, Hayden remembered the SNCC as a womanist, nurturing, and familial organization. In fact, Hayden went so far as to state, "Women's culture and black culture merged for me in the Southern Freedom Movement, especially in SNCC, free of constraints and the values of white patriarchy." What is it that essentially ties black manhood, its aspirations, ideals, and perceptions to random statements or jokes made by black males to sexism and misogyny? What makes an individual's comments come to be understood as the historical consciousness of most, if not all, black males? How does one black man's thoughts in the 1960s come to represent the consciousness of them all, or even a majority of them, throughout time? Context of white supremacy. Dr. Tommy J. Curry, The Man Knot. So we are still in the introduction, very early on, and we're right in the middle of a paragraph. I'll just cue you when we get ready to pick up for the second audio segment, but we're still in the introduction for The Man Knot. The number to dial, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. As we were reading and the sentence came up, Dr. Curry says, he's talking about Michelle Wallace, the Black Macho. Wallace maintained that black men had internalized the white man's obsession with his penis. As she said, white men were perversely obsessed with the black man's genitals, but the obsession turned out to be a communicable disease. And in the 60s, black men came down with high fevers. Woo, I cracked up laughing. Feverish black males. That has been the problem for decades. Feverish black males. Anywho, if we have questions, comments, if folks have any thoughts on the language and processing the book, I said this is going to be a little more challenging, I think, to read, but oh man, lots to chew on. I will have questions, but I'll just get to the line and see if folks have any initial thoughts, questions. And we really have only got to the introduction, so we really have not even really got to the meat of Dr. Curry's presentation. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
I'm hurt.
Thomas in New York, man, do you know who is going to be in Seattle tonight? Drake is doing a concert. I thought of you immediately. Missing out, man. You should have been out here. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah. Yes. Canadian rappers, where this world comes from. Gus, did you get the picture I sent you from the partner at my job? I meant to ask you that last week. Him in African garb, him and his wife.
No, I did not see that. I will check again. I'll be ready for tomorrow, though, if I didn't send it, or if you can send it again, I'll let you know.
Yeah, I'll send it again. Yeah, definitely. Dr. Curry, extremely intelligent, as you know. Doing a great job. I'm following him. We're talking about racism, white supremacy, the number one problem on the planet. Gus, who do you think he's writing this book for?
I think this is an academic publication. I think this is for his colleagues, which would be lots of whites reading the book, although I do think he intended for black people to, I mean, we got a shout out in the text, so I certainly think he also intended for black people to write this book, read this book as well.
Got you. Yeah, I thought that he was writing this book for two white people, and white scholars who may try to discredit his information. So he was wording it very eloquently, crossing his T's and dotting his I's, so to speak. I prefer layman terms. I think when he talks on the show sometimes, he speaks the same way he writes. But it's like, I don't see a lot of black people picking this up that don't understand the system and getting it, because I wouldn't if I didn't have an understanding of some of the concepts that he's using, even though he's, using words. He's not using words we typically use every day. Dr. Wellesley, for example, I think every person can understand her terminologies. To me, this may offer more confusion to a confused person because they won't be getting it. Now, the information is very excellent. It's great. Breaking down the reason why black males are not men in the system of white supremacy, I think it's he's doing a great job. He mentioned logic very early in the text, and that's very important because every system, be it real or artificial, operates off logic. And later he mentioned Darwinism and how that plays an intricate role in how whites relate to blacks or relate to the world. And in my opinion, that's the logic this whole system is operating off of, with other things. But I think that that's very important. And I think he's doing a great job. Very different from the last book, absolutely. But, of course, you know, this is, a scholar. And I'll be with my line. Thank you, Gus.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, may I be heard?
Greetings, Mr. Demery Four.
Yes, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the callers and listeners. Yes, Dr. Curry, brilliant professor. I'm always amazed with the things that he can say and write and still, you know, hold down a professorship at the University of Texas. Of course, I was born in Texas. I know it is in that state. You know, we're only in the introduction, but he started to compare genre with gender. The gender and the genre, you know, so black maleness, whichever way you look at it, you know, you can break it down simple terms like Mr. Nelly Fuller says. It's, you know, we are relegated to the lowest rung in society. So everything is designed, if white's supposed to be superior, then logical deduction would be that black would be inferior. And then the black male would hold that lowest or negative connotation. And all this creating a reality of black male negativity is the work of the system of white supremacy. Hegemony, you know, is a brilliant way to describe it, because if you are under a political and economic and, you know, physical, military or police state, you are helpless. So they exert this control over you, and that becomes your reality. The black masculinity then will be described, you know, the black male would be looking at himself in negative terms, and then would be reacting to the pressures of white supremacy. But you know, I was saying that, I mean, I think leading to the fact that, you know, white, there's nothing that the white people could, you know, I guess, gain from black masculinity, but they are continuously trying to rap, the dress, the manner of speech, you know, as black males. You want to denigrate them, but at the same time, you show the utmost of flattery by imitation, denying patriotic of black males, not being fathers or, you know, perpetuating these lies that you can't be employed or you're underemployed. And then he mentioned patriotic. I guess that would cause the black males to want to exhibit, you know, some type of positive, you know, attributes being relegated to the position that they have, then pick up some patriotic. But it was interesting to find out that Sojourner Truth's frame of mind was that it would be better to be a slave to an educated white man than to be a slave to a black man. You know, I thought that was interesting. I'll mute my line on that. Thanks for taking the call, Gus.
May I heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Red in Nevada. I definitely appreciate this book. It definitely helped me to better understand the correlations between, I guess, what I was taught, and really reading the last book, it made me really think about, like, trying to figure out why I was taught that all black males are feverish. And I know with this book, it kind of helped it when I was trying to read it the first time when it first came out, it helped me to kind of quiet some of those thoughts, to understand that, you know, black people, they are dealing with their own type of terrorism through white supremacy, and not and can't really be patriarchs if they are still subjected. And like Dr. Curry said in one part, how they are effeminized, but yet not female. So they can be effeminized, but they can't also claim the benefits of being a female, especially when it comes to gender theory and the different benefits that white men basically allow some racialized females to receive. I really appreciate even the first page, where it seems like it's really, at least to me, like in layman's terms, basically like his thoughts and really taking contemporary events and kind of really opening the book to what you'll get in it. And I feel like it is definitely hard to follow. Definitely appreciate the tip of having a dictionary, but still just kind of really trying to focus on the full sentence, which is something that's helping me to kind of understand maybe the word that I didn't understand, like testeria. I think that was one of the words. Still really don't know what that really means. But I feel like it's not just a maybe some that I don't think that this would even nowhere, shape or form qualifies anything as being like misogynistic, because he's actually like breaking down what the problems of black males. And again, that's something that is actually helping me as a black female to understand that just because black males, they are bringing up the issues that are occurring with them, does not take away the issues that are happening to black females, because they are, you know, because we are black females, what have you. The other thing, and like Mr. Demery Ford pointed out, definitely appreciate Dr. Curry pointing out just the, I guess, the confusion with Sojourner Truth, and even pointing out the white woman, Elizabeth C. Stanton. I think I pointed that out when we first talked about the book, because I feel like when in school, when we're talking about the women's movement, or women's liberation, I forgot which one, like during like the early, like the 1800s or 1900s, what have you, it was kind of definitely taught as something that was going to help all women, no matter, you know, what color they were. And of course, you know, just a part of the racist school system. And even the part where he gives details about Stokely Carmichael's, like the quote that he said about, you know, what's women's position in SNCC, and how he broke that down. Like, it's, you know, it's not just something that people might just have read once from somewhere else that was misinterpreted from someone else and not even bother to further dig into why it was even said. So again, it's definitely, I feel like it's, you can tell that it's really scholarly. You can tell that it's definitely something that was, that is something that is really well put together. And the one thing I always think about when we, like, you know, hearing about Dr. Curry, is how he said, I know I'm going to mess up the quote, but he was describing, you know, his, you know, males, with his, you know, his theories on, you know, males and black males and gender theory. And he was saying something about how white males can, you know, think of black males as like beasts, but yet they're still, you know, effable. I don't know if you like remember him saying that, but it definitely made me think too, basically what he was kind of describing in the book about how black males are, you know, they're still feminized, but they're also, but they also still have to be the rapist. And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Absolutely. He's talked about that a number of times, where they are feminized and still the rapist. They're disabled and still the rapist. Just there's no escaping that branding, that conviction, black male rapist. Other folks who dialed in with the hand up, line should be open.
Have you heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers and listeners. Codified software developer. I really appreciate the point that Dr. Curry brought up on page 11, where he writes, "The lure of white patriarchy is a common trope used to explain the mimetic urge of black males. But why do we find no assumption of this imitative character in black feminist accounts of black womanhood?" And then he goes on to give a couple of examples. And I would say that I thought that was a very accurate and it was a very good question, because you see it all the time, right? You see it in weddings, you know, where black females, you know, pursue these huge weddings that they see white females having, or in the way we style our hair, or in the way we dress, or the different behaviors that we picked up that we associate with femininity. But I really thought that was a very important point. And also to the point of the previous book, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, when I read what Dr. Curry had to say about Michelle Wallace, and just thinking about how that particular, or how these theories have been sort of propagated in our so-called institutions of higher learning, and how many black women have been indoctrinated into this way of thinking just by going to school. You know, most black women I know went to school and studied the social sciences, so they did come across this sort of theoretical, or this theory of this theorized black maleness, you know, as this patriarchal male. They came across this quite consistently. And even black men that I know who have been in school for social sciences are just as, I guess, sort of just as conditioned to this way of thinking, and oftentimes engage in this sort of discourse themselves. So, I mean, when you really think about that book, when you think about Black Love as a Revolutionary Act, and just how could it come to be from somebody who obviously had a very good, or had a great relationship with a black male yourself, Gus, you know, it's just the indoctrination of this black male patriarchy theory in these institutions of so-called higher learning, where more black females are admitted than black males. So I'm enjoying the text thus far. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Yes, ma'am. Much obliged. To Red and Nevada's point, always love it. Point when folks pick out terms and just making sure that we have an accurate understanding of the term testeric, overly aggressive, irritable, unreasonable. That can be one from being overwhelmed from testosterone is one of the definitions that's consistent. And I think the way that it's used in the text, testeric, the first time that it comes up, he says the black male, the nigger, was constructed as the white race's antipodal monstrosity, a sexual threat to the very foundation of white civilization. If its savagery was not repressed, these speciations from the ideal white male type are examples of the testeric conditions that plagues black maleness generally in the United States, because testeria emerges from the disjunctive isolation black maleness has from the normative maleness that is represented as white. The testeric, or the cool poser, or the eunuch, manifests the repression of the social order corporeally in his flesh. I'll stop there, but I think he's using it in that sense. He keeps saying the mimetic black, as though there's some black person who wants to mimic and behave in a manner like white people. And I think he's saying the system of white supremacy creates these conditions where black masculinity is repressed, and you end up having these testeric responses. Could be a black male is overly aggressive or doing whatever to try to reclaim or assert some level of masculinity, manhood. Does that make sense, Red Nevada?
Yes, it does. Thank you definitely for kind of translating that sentence. I appreciate it.
For sure. It is some work. It is some work. And I might be in error. Dr. Curry might even be listening. He has listened to a program or two before. So he can. We can even ask him. I forgot. We could ask. We could just email Dr. Curry. Help us out. Testeria. Help us out. I'm sure he would be willing to chime in. Other folks we've not heard from at all.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, the callers, listeners, and Gus. Thank you again for the platform. Definitely great, great book. I feel like, well, what I'm understanding from this book is a greater, broader perception of the, or view of the kind of other side. I've had significant others, girlfriends, basically explain intersectionality and all these other concepts, but based on what I've seen and how things that have been playing out with black males worldwide, culturally, it just didn't make any sense. And I feel like what we're getting from Dr. Curry now is a real big and a great understanding of this. I mean, these first couple pages are, it's a lot to take in, so to speak. But I do have to say this, just to, I hope I could do this real quick, but just Dr. Frances Cress Westling, she has a chapter on black child inferiorization. I think that reading her book first and then going into this text is extremely helpful. I feel like this text goes in even deeper into the fact that the black male is the main target in racism, white supremacy. And the points that he, you know, breaking down intersectionality, I'm curious to see how that goes. But one of the lines that definitely struck out, if I may, is black males are not only defined by this lack, they are also thought to be complete only when they stand side by side with white men. Consequently, black masculinity is theorized through this psychoanalytical unconscious yearning for the world of white men, his power, his possessions, which often include white women. And I think that line, like, it gives a good understanding of some of the things that we do see, because black men are trying to reclaim their masculinity, and there I do believe that there are some issues there, definitely with trying to retain what the white men have, but he's giving a deeper understanding and a better understanding as to why these things are occurring, not just because we yearn to be like them, because I don't meet too many black men that want to be just like white men, to be quite frank. That being said, I think that's about it. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, sir. Other folks who dialed in, if we've not heard from you, if you have a hand up, proceed. Did we nab everybody? Anybody we missed who has a hand up?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners on the line. I actually just joined, but I have read the book and I have notes here. Can you tell me where we left off at, Gus?
We are in the introduction still.
Okay. Well, what page have you stopped at?
I have the e-version, so my pages don't correspond. Let's see. We are... I can at least tell you the subsection where we stopped at. So we got past, not all the way through, but we got past Black Masculinity as Buck Studies, documenting the links between hegemonic masculinity and the reality of black males. We got past that, but not completely.
Okay.
14. Oh, okay. There we go.
All right. Okay. So, yeah. So if I'm advancing past, just, you know, let me know and stop me. But like I said, I read this book last year. I had to read it twice because it is, you know, the words are very, you know, it's an academic type of book. So, you know, you have to understand some of these words. And I'm kind of still piecing everything together with words. But it was interesting when on page 13, when he talks about Stokely Carmichael's statement about women in position in SNCC as prone. I'm reminded about the book that we read last year, Coretta Scott King's book, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, when she talks about how the women in the civil rights movement were kind of relegated to the background. And also, too, I know some people have mentioned the last book, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, and I think on page 14, there's Dr. Curry talks about the feminist-inspired theories about black masculinity as inspiring patriarchs. And then he continues to say this approach ignores the actual condition and violence in American society that affects black males and completely disregards the presence of the very same behaviors of other groups. And this fits perfectly of why, you know, the last book was very confusing and why it never applied. You know, it basically applied all the issues, you know, of racism to not only just white people, but to black males, which was, you know, the confusing part of it. So Dr. Curry, to me, that kind of stands out with that statement on why the last book was so confusing. But I got a lot of notes here, but you know what? I'm going to stop right there. But this is a great book, and hopefully you'll get Dr. Curry to define some of these terms that he has in his book. So that's all I have on my line.
We can develop a list as we go. He knows that we are reading the book, and he was overjoyed about it. So I'm sure he would be happy to help us generate a little study guide that could maybe benefit other people who, you know, will read it. Hopefully this will inspire other people to read the book. So I'm sure he'd be happy to help out as we go. Think of questions or terms that you would like to ask him as we proceed. Other folks who we have not heard from at all, do you have commentary? Get everybody, at least for the time being.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, good evening. Hope everybody's having a constructive evening. Thank you for allowing me to speak. Just a couple of things. I'm definitely looking forward to read this book. I've had it since it was announced that it was going to be, that Dr. Curry had published it. Gus, I would point out one thing that's going back to, like, you have the e-version, but back on page 6, where you read the blacklist becomes, you said rationally, but the word is relationally defined as masculine and not feminine. Like I said, it's important to just point that out, the difference in that definition, in that reading. Like I said, definitely it's going to be a great read. I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to try to get as many people to read along as possible. A lot of fascinating content. I wanted to point out a wealth of moment that I noticed at the lower half, where I have the book with me, in the lower half, where he gives his conception of justifiable homicide, and it seems to coincide perfectly with her definition of justifiable homicide is. And that's briefly what it is I have right now. Thank you for that, Mr. Chair. I'll meet my wife.
Much obliged. My fault with the narration. Victim trying. And great comparison with Dr. Welsing's work again, that justifiable homicide portion that she has in the ISIS papers. Links nicely. Did we get all of the folks who dialed in? Did we miss anybody, or at least for the time being, we got everyone? All right. I'll assume we got everyone for the time being. I'll check again before we get to the second audio segment. Let's see. A few of the notes that I took for this one. And I guess if you're listening to the archives, you can email, right? If you have a question, a term, a concept, something you would like to ask Dr. Curry, you could email him yourself. I do try to encourage people to be direct, but if you would like me to submit, I can do it that way. And then if we have three or four, then I can just send him one email as opposed to him getting, 50 from a random assortment of folks. But we should take advantage and ask. Anyway, notes that stood out, I think Red and a few others talked about how the book opens with him just speaking, make it plain, as they say, I see dead black male bodies. First line of the text. And I am scared that one day I will be forced to not speak, and talking about how he is shushed when he tries to bring up issues of black masculinity, which is interesting because I hear that so frequently that, oh, man, everything is just about black males. Everything is about black males. Everything is about black males. And then you have a black male with a PhD, no less, saying I'm trying to address black male issues and I get told to be quiet, or that I'm a patriarch or a sexist for trying to address these issues. Let's see. I thought this was a great point, one of many, where he says, Andrea G. Hunter and James Earl Davis explained studies of black women emphasize how out of oppression, a unique definition of womanhood was forged, one in which adversity gave rise to strength. However, the discourse around men and oppression focuses on the stripping away of manhood. It is a perspective that casts black men as victims and ignores their capacity to define themselves under difficult circumstances. I too thought that that was very important because there are so many of those narratives. And we've talked about on this program how all of that needs to be rejected, that you got this, strong black person as a result of slavery and racism. But I do see that with black females. I do not see that with black males at all, where it's, yes, the all-powerful and mighty black. I do not hear that sort of rhetoric very frequently at all. Not that that would be helpful. Let's see. It's hysteric. We already covered that. Next. He's going to go more into intersectionality later in the book. I'll wait till he deals with that a little later. Let's see. I thought it was great line where he says far too often black males are projected into academic projects as the stereotypes individuals perceive them as, rather than how they actually exist in the world. I thought we had a lot of that in the previous book. This book was written to overwhelm the silence imposed on black males through negative racial caricatures that become absolved of their moral offensiveness once they are called gender theory. Brilliant. You got a whole season. We just talked about this. Dr. Curry, I was feeling like we had just talked to him recently, and we did. He was just on the program. We talked about the U.S. Open and all that in the middle of September. But we talked about this. There's a whole season right now, Insecure, Toxic Black Masculinity. You can say anything. You don't have to have any evidence. You don't have to have any statistics, whatever. Just, hey, this is our new theory about the no good feverish black male, and let it ride. Let's see. Another great line. He says, this book is concerned with the sociological, historical, and ontological weight of black manhood. It explores how the myth of the super predator is codified within the disciplinary proliferation of theories about black masculinity and makes it seemingly impossible to conceptualize the black male as a victim and disadvantage when compared with other groups. I think that is hugely important. Again, we're in an environment where there is legitimate scholarly talk about black male privilege and how it is wonderful. Even having people say that it's wonderful to be a black male because white women love black males. How is this love of black males articulated? Did white women show their love of Emmett Till, Lennon Lacy, James Byrd Jr.? Pick the black male. Did white women show their love for these individuals? Continuing. Already got my line in about fevers. Even that, to have in two books that far apart, Michelle Wallace's The Black Macho, and then in Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, where the culprit, the indictment is made that black males are feverish. Like, what a description. I've said that's the same way that black males were discussed during like the pinnacle of lynching and white terrorism. It was Emmett Till was feverish. It was, you had a black male with sweat pouring down his face, and white woman is like fried chicken. Oh, I can't contain myself. I mean, that's the way we have been described for years. And then to have that reproduced, system of racism, white supremacy. As Dr. Curry states in the book, we have all been subjected to this. That's why I keep pointing out there's a lot of black males who said, oh, yeah, I don't see anything wrong with black love as a revolutionary act. Feverish black men. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Continuing. Next up, he says, this grounding of patriarchy in black male interest and his desire to be or be like the white male is suspicious. It suggests that while black men can articulate themselves as oppressed subjects to myriad structures and ideologies, from racism to classism, imperialism to colonization, and religion to atheism, gender remains unknown to them despite their role in history as subordinated men positioned outside the masculinity of ruling class whites in the United States. Very important. And particularly, Dr. Curry has talked about there being evidence, not just making it up or being in my feelings or just based on my individual experience, but there being lots of evidence that there have been lots of black males, even at the organizational level, not every time, but many, many times, lots of evidence that you could point to where black males have said, yeah, we are not interested in continuing this cycle of finding someone to mistreat. Anybody, male, female, that is trying to get this problem solved and work constructively, let's get at it. And that's, we heard some of that in Dr. Curry's work already. Mumia Abu-Jamal writes about how that was the case even in the Black Panther Party. Obviously not always, but quite frequently. You had a lot of black females in leadership, Asada Shakur being one. Anywho, we read her book in the book club going back 2013, if I am, memory is correct. 2015. I'll get in one more, and then I'll double check and see if other folks have commentary. I think a listener already pointed it out. I think that was the caller in Wisconsin talking about how black females and black males have all of us been subjected to the system of racism, white supremacy, and ideas about how we should think. And we all probably are imitating these racist ideals in some way, shape, form. What he said about Sojourner Truth, I thought that was important. And then where he says the lore of patriarchy is a common trope used to explain the mimetic urge of black males, but why do we find no assumption of this imitative character in black feminist accounts of black womanhood, despite the vast historical works demonstrating the internalization of various Victorian gender ideals and social Darwinist theories, as well as their support for patriarchy as the basis for racial uplift during the 19th century. Very important. All of us have been subjected to. Might be that all of us are feverish. I'll stop there. Other folks, we have about 8 minutes before we get to the second audio segment. Any other questions, problems, a word, a term that stood out that you wanted more input? Folks satisfied.
Greetings, Cappy Hurt.
Oh, retired firefighter. Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm still processing from the last reading, but there's two words that I will consider suggestions from yourself and the other listeners of one's meanings to the words masculinity and patriarchy.
Let's see. I am not sure if he gives a definition of masculinity in the text. I will check to see if he does give a definition of masculinity. I think for patriarchy, it just means male domination over females for patriarchy. I think he's pretty direct about it, unless I miss something. I think he's pretty direct about that one. Masculinity, I will check on. Anyone found definition for masculinity in the book, or a different definition for patriarchy used in the text? Yeah, that's what I thought. That's masculinity. I am checking for now to see if he has a definition for it in the text. Not seeing a definition. Seeing the term used, but not a definition. Is that one you think he should define?
I would say any non-white black person should have the interest to want to have a compensatory understanding of the words, since they're used so much.
Logical point.
I would say, based on that meaning of that you gave with patriarch, that certainly doesn't apply to black males under the system of racism, white supremacy. That's for sure.
I agree there. I think that major theme in Dr. Curry's book that he will come to again and again as we continue to read. But masculinity, patriarchy, that can be too. We can ask why he didn't include definitions for those terms, and or just definition, masculinity, patriarchy. Write those
which,
down.
Which is probably going to be two words that are going to be talked about a lot in the text itself, I would assume. I could be wrong.
Again, I think with patriarchy, he probably will say male domination of female. I generally don't hear a whole lot of confusion about that term in terms of folks not having a grasp of what that term means. And I generally don't hear a lot of different definitions for the term. I think pretty much every time. I can't even think of an exception where it's male the male domination of females, male power, male control over females. But yeah, masculinity, we'll ask about. Did you have anything else? That was it?
That was it.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Any other folks, questions, comments, terms that they wanted to address? Anybody else?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
That was, that's interesting with his definition or how he uses masculinity, because it is, he does use it a lot. And I think, Gus, I think you're probably right with the patriarchy word. But I think he just uses these as kind of like placeholders. I don't think he's labeling black males in patriarchy. I think he's arguing against using it because of the fact that, you know, many other people misuse this term along with black males. So I think that patriarchy term that you find was correct, but he's just kind of arguing against black males in a patriarchal society. So that's all I have any for that.
For sure. Any other thoughts? I thought it was important, his commentary about Sojourner Truth and showing some of the ways that she was a victim as well, in spite of all the work that she did to eradicate white supremacy. She, like the rest of us victims of racism, many other folks who had thought, she believed black men were more brutal than white men, which, I mean, wow, now that shows confusion is lethal in the era that she lived, to believe that black men were more brutal than white men, and black women less intelligent than white women who ruled over them. System of racism.
Have you heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Sorry for interrupting you, Gus. Were you finished?
Oh, go ahead. Yes, fine.
Okay. Thank you. No, I was just going to comment on that. I think it goes back again to that indoctrination of black women or black females into this sort of theorized black male. That she would listen to, or that she would, I guess for lack of a better term, mimic the rhetoric of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, because that indoctrination was happening even then, you know, in these sort of abolitionist, quote-unquote, societies, where you had probably a great deal of white women, and I apologize, I haven't done as much study on this era as I could, but where you probably had a great deal of white women spouting the same nonsense that they're spouting in our so-called institutions of higher learning or in any, or at work even. I've had white women come to me at work with this BS patriarchal nonsense. I think that it just goes back to the indoctrination. And on top of that, you know, you see white females or you see white people, as deities, you know, so to speak. I mean, by that time, they had deified themselves basically to black people. And I think as victims, we're just so accustomed to listening to white people and believing what they have to say, and believing that what they have to say is more important than what we have to say, or that their ideologies or their thought processes are more important than any ideologies or thought processes we can come up on our own. That's all I have there. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, codified software developer. We will transition to the second audio segment. Again, I don't have the physical book, but I think they said we stopped on page 14. I can tell you the exact sentence that we're going to start on. It is, despite the prevalence of arguments to this effect, black women were subjected to the sexist and misandrist ideas of the times no less often than black men were. That's the exact sentence that we're going to pick up on, I think. That's page 14, somewhere around there, should be in the introduction of the text. Shouldn't be that difficult to find. This is Dr. Tommy J. Curry, Texas A&M, multiple-time guest on the context of white supremacy, his book, The Man Not, audio segment number 2. Despite the prevalence of arguments to this effect, Black women were subjected to the sexist and misandrist ideas of the times no less often than Black men were. This is not an issue of masculinity or femininity as much as it is an issue of the assumptions of their day. Gender differences between Black men and women simply did not produce clear delineations of thought and attitudes throughout history. In fact, this is a position articulated by Wallace herself. She explains Black women would define their femininity or their liberation, which was not, however, a movement, in terms of their lack of these superficial masculine characteristics, precisely because the myth of their inferiority, the Black female stereotype, had always portrayed them as oversexed, physically strong, and warlike. Wallace actually argues that the Black macho is only one side of the gender dynamic created by integration. In the process of assimilation, integration, and accommodation, Blacks had taken on the culture and values of whites in regards to sexuality and gender. This did more than make it inevitable that Black men would be sexist or misogynistic. It also made inevitable Black women's completely dysfunctional self-hatred. Yet there is not one exploration of this self-hatred taken on by Black women under the same conditions that allegedly created the Black macho. The superwoman, literally the second half of the title to her book, has not generated any discussion in academic gender theory or Black feminism, despite the claim that, if we accept the Black macho thesis, Black women aspire to the very same end. Feminist-inspired theories of Black masculinity establish their legitimacy by racially profiling Black males. These theories assert a priori that Black males, as a group, are aspiring patriarchs, then surveil the individual behavior of Black men in society or throughout a narrowly selected corpus of literatures accepted by disciplines as evidence of that defect. This approach ignores the actual conditions and violence in American society that affect Black males and completely disregards the presence of the very same behaviors in other groups. Simply put, Black men appear to be explained by gender theory because they are the group most targeted by it. These accounts symbolically biologize Black maleness as the cause of seemingly endless pathologies that are actually expressed by any number of individuals, regardless of their race or gender, who find themselves in similar economic or political conditions. Contemporary thinking about patriarchy condemns Black male violence as an instrument of domination while absolving Black women immersed in the same circumstances who display the same violent behaviors. It has simply become an accepted conceptual practice to construct Black males as malicious because their excess masculinity necessitates the domination of others, while women, regardless of multiple examples of violence, are constructed as ultimately good-intentioned and nonviolent because they are feminine. Hegemonic masculinity theory and the construction of the Black male threat. The problem with asserting Connell's theory as applicable to Black males. The melding together of hegemonic masculinity theory and Wallace's account of the Black macho within contemporary gender discourses is stunning. Sex role theory is heavily dependent on the political economy between men and women founded on the nuclear family in patriarchal societies, so it seems obvious that Wallace is not presenting the Black macho as a sex role historically solidified by the relation between Black men and women within nuclear families. Wallace's rendering of history and slavery maintains that black men and women have been denied the roles of white society because black men and women were prevented from marrying, and accepts that there was a black manhood before the 1960s that was not machoistic. Wallace suggests that white masculinity was an ideal that black men strived to attain given their greater societal opportunities after civil rights. Allegedly, this newfound access to power led black men to not only internalize white Americans' perverse hypersexual stereotypes of black masculinity, but also desire these sexual taboos politically for themselves. Hegemonic masculinity theory resonates with many of the claims introduced by Wallace because Connell's first articulation of hegemonic masculinity was interpreted by scholars in the West as the aspiration toward which all masculinities tended. Hegemonic masculinity was a theory developed by Raewyn Connell in the 1980s. Connell's first work, Ruling Class, Ruling Culture, was a dense study of the Australian ruling class and its conflicts with the working class population. It is unsurprising, then, given Connell's interest in class theory, that Antonio Gramsci's theory of hegemony had some appeal to her evolving thinking about gender. As originally introduced, Connell conceptualized hegemonic masculinity as a single structural fact, the global dominance of men over women. Hegemonic masculinity asserts itself as a heterosexual practice that seeks to dominate women and subordinated masculinities that challenge its definition, such as that of homosexuality. Connell does suggest that Western imperialism and colonialism fundamentally change the configuration of masculinity and femininity in relation to blacks, but this thesis is not fully explored in this earlier work or introduced as a reason that some racialized or impoverished men might not seek to emulate the hegemonic masculine ideal in a given society. Connell is very specific in her deployment of Gramsci's idea of hegemony in this regard. In the concept of hegemonic masculinity, hegemony means, as in Gramsci's analysis of class relations in Italy, from which the term is borrowed, a social ascendancy achieved in a play of social forces that extends beyond contests of brute power into the organization of private life and cultural processes. Ascendancy of one group of men over another achieved at the point of a gun or by the threat of unemployment is not hegemony. Ascendancy, which is embedded in religious doctrine and practice, mass media content, wage structures, the design of housing, welfare, taxation policies, and so forth, is. As a normative aspiration, hegemonic masculinity depends on socializing members of a given patriarchal society to an ideal form. Connell is very clear that the cultural ideal or ideals of masculinity need not correspond at all closely to the actual personalities of the majority of men. Indeed, the winning of hegemony often involves the creation of models of masculinity which are quite specifically fantasy figures. Because hegemonic masculinity is held at the ideological level, there is no need for it to conflict with the emphasized femininity of the society. In fact, they would complement each other. Connell's theory asserts that society is always in a state of play, dynamic, struggling, and meeting challenges against ideology with reification and new ideological rationalizations to support the desirability of the asserted hegemony. Institutions, individuals, and social forces are in constant interaction within the hegemonic masculine culture. There is no stasis or fixity in this account. Connell's subsequent work, Masculinities, begins with a historical and theoretical conscience that is not readily apparent in gender and power. From the outset, Connell is clear that some societies simply do not have the concept of masculinity, much less an ideology of hegemonic masculinity. It simply is not universal. Connell also recognizes that masculinity does not exist except in contrast with femininity. A culture which does not treat women and men as bearers of polarized character types, at least in principle, does not have a concept of masculinity in the sense of modern European American culture. Because it is a gender relation in society, masculinity is subject to social forces like any other relational phenomena. Connell outlines a three-tier model to understand the dynamics of masculinity. The first is power, or what is usually referred to as patriarchy, or the subordination of women and dominance of men in Western European societies. The second is labor, which includes not only wages, but also the gendered division of wealth and work in these societies. Last but not least is kathesis, or sexual desire, extending her Freudian inclinations from gender and power. Connell asserts that the practices that shape and realize desire are thus an aspect of the gender order. As with her reading of Sigmund Freud in her first book, Connell is fascinated by Freud's explication of the psychological and the social. The motivations that drive how one constructs and participates in the external through the permission of one's internal is central in masculinities. In 2002, Connell created a fourth category, symbolization, to capture what is sometimes referred to as performances of identity or the meanings conveyed by individuals through speech, dress, and behavior to assert their gender meanings. Unlike the assertions of many scholars who continue to use masculinity theory, Connell does not have a fixation on a specific politics as the solution to hegemonic masculinity and structures of patriarchy. As she concedes, the formulation in Gender and Power attempted to locate all masculinities and all femininities in terms of a single pattern of power, the global dominance of men over women. While this was useful at the time in preventing the idea of multiple masculinities from collapsing into an array of competing lifestyles, it is now clearly inadequate to our understanding of relations among groups of men and forms of masculinity and of women's relations with dominant masculinities. In sharp contrast to the biologism operating within the premises of American gender theorists, previously highlighted by Oyewumi's criticism of feminist gender analysis, Connell recognizes that dominance in gender relations involves an interplay of costs and benefits. Challenges to hegemonic masculinity arise from the protest masculinities of marginalized ethnic groups, and bourgeois women may appropriate aspects of hegemonic masculinity in constructing corporate or professional careers. Although Connell concedes that masculinity has established particular ways of using male bodies for work, there is no specific biological causality in which subordinated and subjugated masculinities necessarily aspire to embody hegemonic masculinity any more than women of the dominant classes would seek to use that hegemony or emphasized femininity for their own interests. Perhaps more interesting, there is no suggesting that any one politic, feminist or otherwise, remedies the societal instantiations of hegemonic masculinity. To escape the colonial paradigms of gender established on First World taxonomies, Connell herself has called for a shift away from Western concepts of gender altogether. This shift centers masculinities of the global South, founded in anti-colonial struggle, as radical departures from patriarchy. Connell maintains that formulations of Black and indigenous masculinities birthed in conflict with colonialism and the imperial ruling class are non-hegemonic and offer models of resistance to patriarchy. Such developments in Connell's thinking, which place Black men and other racialized males outside the purview of hegemonic masculinity, have been disregarded in American gender theories, which still rely on her much earlier formulations of hegemonic masculinity, as well as a version of Wallace's theory of Black male assimilation into dominant white cultural norms. In short, Connell's theory excludes racialized males from the hegemonic masculinity paradigm, but in the United States, the dominance of Wallace's assimilationist account of Black masculinity makes Black men de facto patriarchs. In the United States, Robert Staples' decades-long work on Black masculinity and the Black family has been reduced to his debate with Audre Lorde and Michelle Wallace in Black Scholar in 1979. Connell, however, recognizes Staples' work as a serious challenge to hegemonic masculinity theory as originally proposed alongside James Messerschmidt's work on working class masculinities. Connell's use of hegemony is meant to explain how gender relations underscore the achievement of hegemonic masculinity largely through cultural ascendancy, discursive persuasion, encouraging all to consent to, coalesce around, and embody such unequal gender relations. For Black males who were racially and sexually excluded from the ruling class, such aspirations were unrealizable. The early work of Black women working on gender and Marxism in the United States made such delineations abundantly clear. Extending Angela Davis's argument in Reflections on the Black Women's Role in the Community of Slaves concerning the objective equality between Black men and women from slavery to the civil rights era, Gloria Joseph, a Marxist Black feminist, argued that the documented history of Black women and men in the area of labor thus reveals that the peculiar institution of slavery played a curious role in bringing about equality among Black men and women, as opposed to the inequality that was fostered among white women and men. Because Black males, in terms of class position and a caste position as racialized laborers, are structurally excluded from the ruling class, serious thought was given in the late 1970s and early 1980s to their gender orientation and whether or not they could even participate in the historical and economic system of white patriarchy. Remember, Connell has been developing her theory of gender and hegemonic masculinity since 1982. Her preliminary theories were based on her initial study of Australian high school boys from ruling class and working class families and the class aspirations reflected in the curriculum of these schools. It is a commonly articulated position with the advent of standpoint epistemology that gender theories demand specificity to their subjects. It is often assumed that works by Black women theorists entail some visceral, social, historical, cultural connection to Black women, for example. In the case of heterosexual Black men, however, there is a belief that their intentions and motives can be adequately captured by generic theories of masculinity formulated on male children in colonial societies and upper-class settler culture. The asserted closeness that black males, among the poorest, most uneducated, and most isolated, unassimilated members of American society, are thought to have hegemonic masculinity and white patriarchy is evidence not of their actual power or aspirations for white male domination, but of the extent to which theorists and scholars have internalized the negative stereotypes about black males as hypermasculine, violent, and dangerous. Instead of being specific inquiries into the attitudes, history, and destiny of black men, theories concerning black masculinity are merely an attempt to read black men into the legacy established by white masculinity and condemn their political or economic aspirations that do not share the political motifs of liberal black feminism as patriarchal. Under current disciplinary perspectives, black males are denied the courtesy extended to other males throughout the world. The ability to organically formulate and practice non-patriarchal forms of manhood that are not dependent on feminist political norms. Challenging the caricature of the hegemonic black male. The sociological findings of black male gender attitudes. Despite the mountains of empirical and conceptual ventures identifying and defining multiple notions of manhood and boyhood among black males that dislodge the essentialist thesis asserted by Wallace, much of gender theory remains dedicated to the paradigm asserting black heterosexual masculinity as the buck or black macho caricature. Whereas mainstream white theories of patriarchy are debated and nuanced so that the theory, like Connell's, can be tested with empirical research, assertions about black masculinity are taken as fact to be complete and, moreover, incontrovertible, posing challenges to prevailing theories maintaining that black men are sexist, patriarchal, and set on domination are met with moral condemnation while introducing material history to challenge the historiography maintaining that black men pursued civil rights and black power to gain the right to dominate women and have sexual access to white women is classified as apologetics and summarily dismissed as caping for black men. In a very real sense, theory mirrors the cultural and social context of its origin, and, like the society from which it springs, academic gender theory is accepted as true because it rationalizes the accepted stereotypes of black males held by the general public. There is a comfort found in theory that is not offered by public opinion, a correctness of sorts married to the word, despite it being no better founded than personal anecdote or experience. Black masculinity theory gains acceptance through an ideological rigidity that equates any disputing of the claim that black men are patriarchs and sexist to a denial that sexism and patriarchy exist in black communities. It is actually quite simple to hold that black men are not patriarchs but are socialized to accept sexism, just as easy as it is to posit that in a racist society where black males are criminalized and systemically impoverished, black men and women are taught to pathologize that population. Nuance need not constitute denial. Staples' Black Masculinity, the Black Male's Role in American Society, although rarely cited today in gender theory, is widely acknowledged as being among the first empirically driven analyses of black males in American society. It shares this distinction with Lawrence E. Gary's anthology, Black Men, which was published by Sage in 1981. contrary to the long-standing mythology that all race scholarship during the 1960s and 1970s was dedicated to the plight of the black male, it became evident in the late 1970s that social scientists knew very little empirically about black men and boys. Given the proliferation of texts about black women and girls in the early 1970s, such as Joyce Ladner's Tomorrow's Tomorrow, LaFrances Rogers Rose's The Black Woman, and The Black Macho and the Myth of the Superwoman, Gary noted, although these publications have added considerably to our knowledge of black women and their families, to some extent, they have created the impression in the minds of many people that the black community functions primarily as a matriarchal family system. In fact, so little attention has been given to black men as fathers and husbands that they have been referred to as the phantom of American family studies. Early depictions of black males in the social science literature characterized them as street corner men, pimps, deserters, criminals, hustlers, or ineffective family figureheads. These depictions were not research. Rather, they were myths used to explain the specific racial, sexual, and economic position under which black males suffer as the product of their own cultural deficiencies. Black males were defined as problems, threats. They were projected as psychologically impotent and castrated, dependent, incredulous, nebulous, irresponsible, and suspicious, and thereby responsible for their own lowly position in society. Staples took a different approach in his study of black men and boys in American society. He held that institutional racism and its machinations shaped the expression of black masculinity in America, and that this reality cannot be discounted in seeking to understand both the black male's subjective experiences of manhood and the objective consequences of being both black and male. The historical circumstances of black males in America gave rise to fundamentally different notions of manhood from those of white males. In the case of black men, their subordination as a racial minority has more than canceled out their advantages as male in the larger society. Staples insisted that this precarious position meant that any understanding of their experience will have to come from an analysis of the complex problems they face as blacks and as men. Staples named this the dual dilemma. To many readers, this idea sounds like contemporary theories such as intersectionality, in that it suggests that every subject is both raced and sexed. However, this idea was initially published in 1978 in the Journal of Social Issues, a full decade before the term intersectionality was developed. Staples maintained that black men had few privileges in America except in relation to black women, and that black men had higher incomes than black women in the 1970s. Staples does not attend to the wit of history. In an era that witnessed the burgeoning of black nationalism, with its attendant elevation of the black male to his rightful and historical role as the head of the black family and community, it was women, mostly white women, who gained political and economic ascendancy from the civil rights movement. Staples maintains that the economic and political isolation of black men and boys gave them more egalitarian views of sex. It is generally conceded that black men do not have the power to enact patriarchy to the extent that white men do. But this structural limitation is rarely connected to or thought of as a reason that black men would formulate altogether different notions of manhood that resist gender hierarchies not only in the home, but also in the larger society. Black men are by far the most liberal sex-race grouping in America. They start dating earlier, have the most liberal sexual attitudes, and are most inclined to have non-marital sex without commitment. Within the institution of marriage, Black men are more involved than other males in doing housework, tending to children, and sharing decision-making with their female counterparts. Recent studies actually show that Black fathers are more involved with their children than men of other races, even when they are not married or living with the mother, and they practice social fathering to the Black community at large in recognition of the structural violence that robs Black families and children of Black men's presence generally. Black men are not mimetic in the sense that they simply base their life aspirations or behavior on the precepts established by the larger white society. The sociologists Anthony Lamell Jr. and Juan Battle showed that in the Black community, homophobia and homosexuality are equally stigmatized identities, and it is religious participation as well as one's gender rather than masculinity itself that indicate the likelihood that Black men or women will be homophobic and express homonegativity. Black males' attitudes concerning sex, love, marriage, and manhood itself differ largely from those of whites. What Black men do, how they behave, is more of a sociological than a philosophical point, but it is precisely how Black men and boys live out these perspectives in societies that gives their experience of themselves and the world theoretical import. Alrighty, that is the end of our first installment on The Man Knot, and we are still in the introduction. We have a ways to go before we conclude the introduction, but we will make more progress next week and hopefully get it to chapter one. With that, the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We have about 30 minutes. All of the folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open. If you did not get an opportunity to speak the first time around and you would like to share, you should go ahead and get a hand up. Don't wait till the last moment. That way we will make sure we do not miss your hand. Everyone who dialed in with a hand up, line is open. Proceed. Folks that are with us lollygagging, nothing stood out from second segment, or folks biding their time?
I would say the term masculinity in the second half came up a lot, and it kind of is helping me formulate a meaning, a clear meaning. It's not like I first time ever hearing the word, anything like that, but it's giving me a clearer meaning to the word. Right now, I'm just thinking in my mind traditional male behavior, but it also could be practiced by someone other than a male. It's far from my observations. I'm talking about the word masculinity.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Word will continue to come up, so we'll see if your thoughts on the word and how it's used in the text, how it changes as we proceed, and we will ask Dr. Curry about that term specifically. Let's see. We did not hear from Emmy first time around. Emmy, if you have commentary, wonderful to hear from you.
Greetings, everyone. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Unfortunately, I'm having difficulty getting the ebook. For some reason, it wasn't downloading, so I actually can't quote anything directly. I'll make sure to rectify that problem in the future. But so I'll just have to share my commentary, kind of like big picture, big idea, big themes that I took away. In the first narration, the first part of today's reading, I thought that it was extremely interesting, and I don't want to forget it because I was so busy trying to download the thing. Let me skip to the second part, and then maybe the first part will come. So, you know, this is one of the things, this is why part of the reason I don't watch television. I don't like television, but I also think that it completely obscures reality. I mean, I feel there's enough evidence to suggest that it's intended to. And so by constantly consuming television specifically, but really just media in general, you don't see those positive images of Black males or males classified as Black, whatever. But, you know, it's very interesting when you kind of stop watching television or stop participating in those types of things where you're consuming what most people are consuming and begin to pay attention only to what is like real and tangible in your face. And in my experience, the data that was presented in the second part of the reading is very reflective of my experience of Black males. That, you know, I would love to see the studies, even just to know how they were able to conduct the study, like was it self-reporting or whatever. But all of that aside, you know, the Black males that I know that are close to me and my family, they are supportive in the household. They are very close to children. Or like to the children, and are very nurturing. And the more I, you know, build upon those relationships, these kinds of things get highlighted so much more. And I can even tell my own conditioning, because I myself could be a little surprised when I first began to see it, you know, especially expression of emotion or sensitive emotion or being sensitive or vulnerability and all of these things. And I'm very excited about that being part of the conversation, because I think although I cannot provide any definition for masculinity, the connotation that I have, like the colloquial way with which I kind of understand the word masculinity, there's enough evidence in my experience, at least, to suggest that it's a very limiting box for, you know, Black males to be in, because it completely negates an entire range of like human expression and emotion and feeling and all those types of things. And I really do want to look at the data, because I think that that's true. Like even the Black males that I've met that maybe perhaps were unable to be provident for their children or their families or whatever in the way that they might have wanted to, or like the female partner might have wanted, really love their children. Deeply love their children, love to be around their children and spend time with their children. And that's not to say I haven't met some that, you know, don't, but overwhelmingly, I meet Black men who are very proud that they have children, love, like I said, everything I just said. And you don't see that on television whatsoever. And I guess depending if you are on social media and like what pages and stuff you follow, you might see some of those positive images, but you know, that seems very limiting. But I mean, in real life, that is my experience. And so very excited that that's like in the text already from the very beginning. And if the first part comes to me, I'll just try to chime back in. I don't want to ramble. So thank you all for listening.
Much obliged, Emmy. I think that did come up in Black Love as a Revolutionary Act. In fact, I remember it explicitly, where it was mentioned it was a Black female included an anecdote where she said she would watch television and see a Black male feverish with a white woman on TV. And then she would go outside and see an authentic Black male who was not with a white woman, at least at the time. And she'd be so angry with him. And he hadn't said anything, hadn't done anything, wasn't, you know, doing anything incorrect. And just from what she saw on television, which, I mean, reading would be more important than watching television. Others with a hand up. Yes, ma'am. Okay. Emmy, sorry, I heard both of you.
I did remember.
She can go if she wants.
All right.
Thank you. I really do appreciate it, only because I had to fight to hold on to that thought. So I'm going to just get it out really, really quick. The big theme takeaway point from the first part of the reading that, you know, I think it was like mind blown, but a reminder. Like I'd heard about it before, but to be reminded of it is really, really important, that
and I'm paraphrasing, so it might be completely like stated in a way incorrectly, but this is how I internalized it, that white males or men had to create like nigger masculinity, so to speak, in order to have white male masculinity. And so I feel that, you know, I've heard this concept when it comes to pretty much like, I'm the real thing because they're not. All that savagery type stuff that they're doing, the way they dress, the way they eat, the way they have sex, the way they, like, I'll just be the complete opposite and then say that what they're doing is not what I am. I'm the real thing. And so that's kind of, I thought that was just fascinating because that makes so much sense. You, and then the thing is, the thing that you keep saying that you're not talking about white people is the very same thing that they are, that they keep trying to say that the black male is. Really, it's the white male who is the rapist and the pedophile, and I'd even go so far as to say the homosexual. Even now, when you look around, when people think homosexual male, they a lot of times think black male, when really it's the white male who's the homosexual. And so it's that kind of, I hope I made some sense, but that I'll try to get better at stating that, but that I took that away and it was profound for me. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Glad your thought came back to you. I hate it when that happens. Let's see. The male who yielded the floor. Thank you kindly.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. On page 21, the statement, recent studies actually show that black fathers are more involved with their children than men of other race, even when they're not married or living with the mother. And they practice social fathering to the black community at large in recognition of the structural violence that robs black family and children of black men's presence generally. Now, despite the fact that, you know, this sentence or has the term black community, I think I'm getting at what Dr. Curry is saying. But to the last caller, Emmy's point, these statistics, I'm looking at the notes from it, and these statistics come from a periodical, the National Health Statistics Report, which is titled Fathers' Involvement with Their Children in the United States. And then there's another periodical, Journal of Black Studies. I wanted to return the favor, the experience and perspectives of black social fathers. And so just like what the what Emmy said, you know, I don't know any black males who basically said, okay, I just don't want to be a father. You know, it's basically, you know, we get the image of, you know, we're shirking our responsibilities as being, you know, fathers or attempted fathers, if you're looking at the and through it to the system of white supremacy. But I just don't know any black males who just decide, I just don't want to be a father, because in most of our cases, most of the children who don't have fathers in their home is either the father is dead or in jail. So that's why we don't have fathers, because they're incarcerating us and they're killing us. So this myth of we're not, you know, we don't want to be fathers is, you know, is just, you know, like I said, and I appreciate this bringing Dr. Kerr bringing these reports out as well. So that's all I have on me in my line.
Dense reference section with this book. Others that we've not heard from?
Can I be heard?
Codified software developer?
Yes, sir. So I really appreciated Emmy's commentary. I was about to say the same thing, that regardless of the images of black males that were shown on a daily, consistent basis, those images do not match the black males that I know personally. So I appreciated her commentary on that. I would say on page 19, where he talks about, where he says, posing challenges to prevailing theories, maintaining that black men are sexist, patriarchal, and set on domination are met with more condemnation
while introducing material history that challenged the historiography, maintaining that Black men pursued civil rights and Black power to gain the right to dominate women and have sexual access to white women, is classified as apologetics and summarily dismissed as caping for Black men. I myself have had, just as a sort of personal note, I myself have been in a position where I have presented evidence against these sort of so-called feminist theories, Black feminist theories, that the Black male is patriarchal and is dominant and wants to force his, I guess, brand of oppression, for lack of a better term, on Black females, and have been met with the same sort of rhetoric, including, this new term, or maybe not that new, being Black male identified, quote unquote. And when I ask what that means, no one can tell me what that means. So I think it's unfortunate that if you speak to sort of defend Black men with, honest empirical data with facts, right? When you speak to defend Black men, that you are just dismissed as being sort of an apologist for Black men, or being quote unquote Black male identified. I have no idea what that means, and I don't really understand what would be so wrong about that. But that's all I have. Thanks so much. I'll meet my line.
Wow, terms are important. There's a term, white identified, identifying a major problem, product of the system of white supremacy, and now you have the term Black male identified, as though there are just hordes of individuals out there who love Black brothers and identify with their perspective and cape for them and make sure that they're safe and taken care of on a daily basis. Yes. Others that we've not heard from at all. We nab everybody. Grant, I'll share a thought or two before we get to the end. If you have a question or a thought, we are getting close to the conclusion, so don't wait until the very end if you think you have a thought. Let's see some of the notes that I took from the latter portion of the read. I thought the hypocrisy was so important. It reminded me of the sexual component that we talked about last week, with all of the harpooning of Black males for allegedly being with white women, where he said, this is him talking about Michelle Wallace's Black Macho, talking about integration, quote unquote. It also made inevitable Black women's completely dysfunctional self-hatred, yet there is not one exploration of this self-hatred taken on by Black women under the same conditions that allegedly created the Black Macho. The Superwoman, literally the second half of the title to her book, has not generated any discussion in academic gender theory or Black feminism, despite the claim that if we accept the Black Macho thesis, Black women aspire to the very same end. If that is true in the system of racism, white supremacy, then I think we should be very mindful in how we present information. That's something that I talk about consistently, that you don't have what they call a Black gender war. You just have anti-Blackness, period. And really, in the system of racism, white supremacy, non-white people do not get along, period. Worldwide, it's not just Black people. All of the victims of racism, white supremacy, do not have constructive relations. It's not just male, female. Black males and other Black males are in conflict. Black females and Black females are in conflict. Just really, I think, be mindful anytime that an argument gets presented in a very one-sided manner, as though it's just one group that has this affliction, and it's not all of the victims of racism, white supremacy, who are participating in something. Be very leery when that sort of thing happens. Let's see. And even back to go earlier in the same page, where he says, gender differences between black men and women simply did not produce clear delineations of thought and attitudes throughout history. And I think, again, directly because of the system of racism, white supremacy, we're all being subjected to the same types of racist tropes, racist ideas, symbol formation, as Dr. Welsing talks about. It doesn't mean that it impacts us all in the same way. But a lot of this messaging, we've all been watching television. Everybody watched Scandal and, you know, all the rest of the nonsense. Let's see. Let's see. Oh, I thought this was a great one, too. He says, the asserted closeness that black males among the poorest, most uneducated, and most isolated, unassimilated members of American society are thought to have hegemonic masculinity and white patriarchy is evidence not of their actual power or aspirations for white male domination, but of the extent to which theorists and scholars have internalized the negative stereotypes about black males as hyper-masculine, violent, and dangerous. I think that brilliant, brilliant point. Not having any evidence, it's so easy to fall back into talking about black people in general. We're talking about black males specifically. With this text, everything about the system of white supremacy, the inertia is to just to fall back into that trope regardless. That's why I said with Andrew Gillum, same thing. Matter of fact, when they did the Florida gubernatorial debate, when Ron DeSantis suspected racist, he started talking about crime. He spent a little, he kept going back that there's so much crime. Mr. Gillum's the mayor of Tallahassee. It's overwhelmed with crime. They've got murders every day. Violence. Again, connection. Black male, violence. Uncontrollable beasts. You're monkeying around. All of the same stereotypes about black males. That's just the default of what it's supposed to be. And apparently you can be very successful with that, even if you're writing scholarly books and maligning black males. Just fall back on the reliable rapists, beasts, patriarchs. They're just out to get us all, and they need to be controlled, beaten, maybe. Let's see. Any last comments? I want to make sure.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
Yes, there was page 17 where he was dealing with Connell's basically her studies. I really, really appreciated the fact that he was breaking down a lot of the origins of these words, these hegemonic masculinity and all these things, where they come from, coming to the root. And it begs the question, and I put it on the table for anybody too, is, doesn't this mean essentially that either there are one or two things that occurred, which is the other professors and other people who are in depth in this field either didn't read this or didn't do significant research on this study that he's obviously been able to come across and pick up, or they completely ignored it in order to consistently keep the ongoing perception and image of the black male as being hegemonic. And this on the page 17 at the bottom, she writes, such developments in Connell's thinking, which place black men and other racialized males outside the purview of hegemonic masculinity, have been disregarded in American gender theories, which still rely on her much earlier formulations of hegemonic masculinity, as well as a version of Wallace's theory of black male assimilation into dominant white culture norms. Like, it, to me, it just seems like in the West, they've just literally put they grabbed her first work and ran with that and didn't really give any other privilege to, like, or any energy towards her further work as she studied more. And this kind of Dr. Amos Wilson's book, Black on Black Violence, where he deals with why it's important for the image of the black male to be viewed as violent, for not only mainly for the economic means, but also as a means to keep the black male suppressed and down in society. And this is like correlating exactly with what he's saying. Like, there's so much, again, even with with Dr. Krausen's work as well, like it's all crossing at some points where all these theories are coming together and they're making absolute sense based on reading some of the work right here. But I do put that on the table. Like, do we mostly, as well as yourself, because do you think like they've just, I think personally they've obviously just left that out on purpose, but what about the Black feminists that claim that they are extensively knowledgeable in this field, and it doesn't seem like they've even read the origins of these words? And that being said, I'll mute my line.
Much obliged. Appreciate the question. My quick view, it's hard to say, obviously. I certainly think with regards to whites, it would not surprise me. In fact, I'd be willing to venture that many of them are aware of Connell's work and her revisions, updates. A lot of whites in the academic world, you know, they brag about being scholarly and, you know, being up to date on the latest publications and what have you. So I'm sure a number of them are aware, but they're just practicing racism and deliberately ignoring the updates to this work. In terms of non-white people or feminists, that could be the case as well, where some of them know. I also think in a system of white supremacy, I think Dr. Curry talks about this, that it is easy. If you want to be in racist dominated academic institutions, it is very, very easy. If you want to go along to get along, as they say, bash on Black people, Black males specifically, be about feminism and these no good Black male identified, whatever it is, ought to be about that toxic Black masculinity. If you want to research about that, if you want to write about that, if you want to talk about that, you can do fine. It would not surprise me if you have a number of non-whites who are into gender studies or whatever that is, who don't question, just, hey, this is my interest. It's there. I'm being encouraged to pursue this, and I'm not being maligned and attacked and what have you. I'll just go along and do this, and you know, I can do well and get my interest published. You see what happened. Dr. Curry has talked about repeatedly, when you try to go the opposite way and push against that, it can be trouble for you. Might not have tenure for you. So white racists, they have a way of making you go along to support their system, their objective, if that answers the question. Do other folks want to respond to that question or have a final thought before we get ready to wrap up?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I double majored in gender, sexuality, and women's studies. And I mean, I'm still confused now, and I was way more confused then. I think part of the problem is when you're educated by or indoctrinated by suspected racist white supremacists who have their own agenda for what it is that they're teaching, you know, very eager, passionate, you know, young people who are taking these social sciences, and they have their own agenda that they're pushing. And so, yes, that's the short of it. And then I think outside of the institution of academia, I think part of what makes having this conversation so difficult, I don't know about specifically like why no one picked up this person's work. I mean, there's so much written all the time. I don't know. But in terms of being able to converse about this topic, I think part of it is not having the language to do so, like the everyday language. That's one of the things that I'm so, like, I learn all the time, that sometimes the concept is not that it's so far out of the reach of a person, but if you don't have the right words to express it, it becomes very difficult to have that conversation or to move the conversation forward or to even think in that way, because you don't have the words to frame what you're trying to think. I hope I answered your question in some type of way, at least from my very limited perspective. One thing I just wanted to mention also in this session is I think it's just so, so important to always remember that, at least for me, that prior to the establishment of the system of racism, white supremacy, non-white people were doing us all around the world, however we were doing it. And sometimes I think because we just don't have that memory, like we just don't have the record and we don't have the memory, that we feel very confined to form our whatever it is, in this case, gender identity, if, you know, people want to use that terminology, in the only way that we can think about it, because the only way that we see it. But in the second half of the reading, the author was making the point
that, you know, like gender expression, like there wasn't, the masculinity is not in every culture, that, you know, the lines between what women do or what men do is like a little bit more blurry. And I think that that's really, really freeing, especially, you know, if we could take that on and expound upon it. But we do, like, you know, Europeans are very, or, you know, white people are very binary, very, you know, like that. So it's, and these polar opposites, dichotomies or whatever, that just create a lot of confusion as well. So just something that I'll be thinking about as we continue, you know, on. So thanks for listening.
Spectacular. Much obliged. Final thought from Emmy. We will rejoin this conversation next Thursday, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Hopefully it was not too difficult of a transition to move the book club to Thursdays, workplace racism to Fridays. That's what we'll do tomorrow, neutralizing workplace racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Hopefully will be seamless. If you have thoughts, comments, questions, again, I have my list, So Masculine, already on the list to ask Dr. Curry as we roll through the book. If you have other questions, if you listen to the archives, you can drop an email. We'll write them down. We will submit, see if we can get answers from Dr. Curry. Much obliged to all the folks who participated. I hope it was a constructive investment. Your Thursday evening, first day of November, the cold weather approaches. Stay safe and constructive as usual. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Dr. Welsing, mentioned repeatedly on the broadcast, certainly would encourage us to protect our brain computers so that we can crank out a permanent solution to the problem that is our cosmic assignment. Right in line, in addition to being sober, each and every time we are in a vehicle, we should be buckled up, driver or passenger. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.